Case for argument is Lester v. Peterson. Mr. Roosevelt.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it may please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Greg Roosevelt. I represent the defendant appellants Evan and Michelle Peterson and Dovetail Incorporated. This small company had an employee, Sandra Lester, who filed suit on May 16 of 05. Concerning some matching contributions, sales commissions, withholdings, and a myriad of issues stemming from that employment relationship under ERISA. On April 7, 1999, some $1,243 in withholding was taken from her paycheck for her contribution to her 401k and not subsequently deposited to the 401k account. In time following, also there were matching contributions, which the company she expected would make based upon her contributions to her 401k. Also, she claims to have earned sales commissions during a period of time which she did sales work for the company based upon certain performance criteria. There was no written contract. The plaintiff claims, however, that she earned the same and they were not paid. The significant issue from our perspective is the statute of limitations issue. The plaintiff, as the briefing and exhibits would demonstrate, is a doctorate level individual who knew that the withholding on April 7, 1999 occurred and then took no steps or action regarding assuring specifically, other than writing immediately her employers and various communications and emails. She testified, and the exhibits demonstrated that she spoke to her accountant regarding the same. He warned her that these funds were going into a black hole. No doubt that she had knowledge, detailed knowledge, of the facts stemming from the problem with the withholding.
And you're right, she notified her employer, and then they promised to make the payments. So why doesn't equitable tolling apply?
Because there's no pleading here of fraud or estoppel.
No, you don't need that for equitable tolling. That's equitable estoppel. Equitable tolling is any situation which, you know, it was reasonable for the plaintiff to delay.
And, in fact, if it was reasonable. In this instance, it was 6 years, more than 6 years, between the time that the event occurred on April 7, 1999.
But didn't the company keep telling her it would meet its obligations? I mean, first there was the salary reduction, which she agreed to. And, you know, she had come from another company. They had worked together before. They kept promising her they were going to pay. That, I mean, to me, that's your biggest problem.
I think the fact of representations that also that there were financial difficulties, as you pointed out, there was a salary reduction present. There were issues with ultimately reducing the benefit plans and taking the dental and the disability plans off the table. Certainly, both sides understood those conditions. To wait 6 years, even beyond any representations that may have been made by the defendant that, yes, we'll address it or, yes, we'll work to correct it, is way beyond the pale of what one would reasonably expect to be a representation that you could rely upon.
With regard to equitable tolling or equitable estoppel, so what, you want us to make findings or what?
I think inherently that is you're speaking to findings of fact by the
With regard to, you know, the reasonableness of her delaying her suit.
Yes, and there are.
Whether she was lulled by what, that would have to be equitable estoppel, if she was lulled by your clients saying they'd work it out. So wouldn't that have to be for the district judge to decide in the first instance?
Absolutely. I agree. In terms of the district court judge saw the witnesses and heard the evidence and is in a better position to make a judgment as to whether there would be such a tolling or a stop or whether that's reasonable. He heard the testimony of all witnesses concerned. So it's a lack of those findings, and one of the issues we're presenting to the court, particularly on the statute of limitations, is the lack of addressing those issues associated with that statute of limitations issue.
But that, wouldn't that require a remand rather than a reversal?
I believe that a remand, Your Honor, is an option here. The court, in terms of what we're looking at getting the case to a posture where there are adequate record of findings of fact and law, the court has already heard the evidence and the testimony. That certainly I would urge upon the court as being an option. The sales commissions, Your Honor, if I may just briefly, in that instance, we take the position that there was no contract. She was an at-will employee. And simply because someone earned money in the employment relationship or believed they are owed money, for instance, in a sales commission situation, and chooses later to fund a 401k and make the matching contribution from that source, doesn't turn it into an ERISA plan asset. We feel that those commissions then are not part of the plan assets and are not part of what Congress has contemplated being part of this ERISA scheme. Beyond that, there's more significant issues, again, with the statute of limitations and preemption under a contract.
But this claim for
period.
Unpaid commission isn't based on ERISA, right?
It can't be.
Right, it can't be. It's a state law claim, and so we have a 10-year statute of limitations on the breach of contract.
However, it is preempted, in our opinion and view, by
how is it based on benefits under an employee benefit plan?
Well, that's apparently how the district court is seeing it. But I don't see that it can possibly be part of simply because you paid that source of money in the 401k. The monies could have just likely come from winnings in Las Vegas. That doesn't turn them into plan assets. And so for that reason, ERISA preempts the state contract claim. Again, I'm not conceding that there's a contract.
Well, what's her remedy?
We believe there is no remedy because we believe the evidence doesn't support a claim that she earned those commissions, and we deny that the commissions were earned.
If she did, I mean, would that be an ERISA claim or a breach of...
Clearly not. She
well,
could.
I don't understand your preemption. I don't get your argument.
If she
was owed commissions and she wasn't paid, she has a claim, doesn't she?
She may, and she may
what
have.
What would that claim be? Would that be under state law or ERISA or what?
It would certainly be under state law at that point for a claim breach of contract that is promised that right. she would...
So what's the preemption? I don't get it.
Well, we're simply arguing that the court has put this in damages as a finding under loss of and made calculations which support this lost opportunity under this 401k account, and therefore it gets mixed up in the calculation of a loss of economic opportunity under the 401k plan and account. And I think it's not clear where he was deciding or how he was deciding that issue. So we think properly that issue has not been proven, and it's error to grant that relief. Regarding the health care or the termination of various plans, I think it's important to remember that the plaintiff terminated her participation in the plan in June of 2004, enrolled these funds into an IRA, and on July 31st, 2004, the plan was terminated. We do not believe she meets the definition of a participant in that she had no reasonable expectation of returning to the employ of this defendant, and certainly had, at the point that she went in her own direction with her own personal IRA, had no intention or claim to at some point rejoin the firm or to have some expectation of a benefit from this plan in the future. So she lacks standing as a participant also.
Can we just talk about this investment loss for a minute? I know your position is that it shouldn't have been included. But if we disagree with you, do you have any problem with the method used to calculate the loss?
Our objection is to the expert's decision-making and his and a criticism of his connection to the defendant because he was employed by the defendant or the plaintiff's husband. We attacked his credibility on that basis. Beyond that, his calculation of figures are what he came up with, and you will see that the defendant had no expert that came in and said, okay, his...
Those numbers were wrong.
His numbers are wrong,
okay.
Yeah. So you end up with... They are what they are,
okay.
Your Honor.
I just wanted to verify that.
Yeah. I'd like to, if I may, reserve time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Riva?
I will get around to making some comments in response to the court's questions to counsel, but we do have a cross appeal. I want to speak briefly to that to make sure that you get my position across on that issue. We really have two points. One, I think, is real easy. Our expert, Mr. Murphy, came in, gave unrebutted testimony that the nature of a 401k plan is not just to have money come into it, but it's also to generate earnings over the years tax-free. Judge Baker did give us the amount that was to be paid in and the, as the court, Judge Williams has said, the investment loss, which we consider all one component of a 401k benefit. But he did not, on the unrebutted evidence, give us the additional amount that Mr. Murphy had calculated by virtue of the fact that he ran out the calculations for the tax issue. In this particular case,
well, if you deduct the expected tax liability when they cash out their 401k,
I'm not sure that he did that, but again, the only...
Look, that's critical, right? Because when you don't pay the taxes when the contributions are made, you have to pay it when you take it out, when you're old.
Right.
And that has a present value, that or present cost, that that future tax liability. You have to subtract that from any tax benefits that you calculate. Was that done?
I don't believe it was.
Yeah,
but
well,
also,
that's no
it
good
was,
if it's
it,
not
it was,
done.
It was not raised,
have,
though.
It doesn't matter. It has to, look, a responsible calculation of the tax benefits has to take account of the fact that eventually the taxes have to be paid, and that the present cost of that future tax liability has to be deducted from any tax benefits.
I would stand on, there's an exhibit where Murphy went through the calculations. If it's in there, I would say that we stand on that as the unrebutted
stand
analysis.
On it if he didn't. If he
I'm
didn't,
saying, if he didn't. I'm saying
he said he didn't.
I'm saying if his report says he did it.
Did what?
What you just indicated.
He just said the opposite 2 minutes ago.
I retract that. I'm saying whatever he said.
You mean you don't know?
At this point, I don't because it's. I'm not. Unfortunately, I'm not a tax lawyer.
Not a
so what I'm saying is, if
business,
he did specifically say he took that and did the analysis the court is indicating, then we should get.
You're saying that's in the record.
It either is or isn't.
It is. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
The exhibit is in. I think it's 142. He has a whole letter opinion. It's 3 pages long with calculations. I would believe that someone who was charged with that duty would make that calculation. Quickly, onto the statutory penalties argument. What we're urging error in Judge Baker's conclusion was, here's what he had before him. He had a plaintiff who had made numerous repeated requests for multiple documents, long-term disability plan, summary plan description, summary plan documents, annual
reports.
What
kind of discretion does the judge have with regard to awarding these statutory penalties? Any discretion or what?
I believe he has discretion, but I think limited by the law, and we do not believe that self-professed claim.
What can he take into account in exercising his discretion?
Okay, he can take into account, that's where I was going, he can take into account how many requests were made, the length of time that the person was given the runaround, which he mentioned in his ruling, the fact that there were few employees. This is not a case where it's
been... Aren't the statutory penalties per day?
Yes.
Well, then how does length of time affect, how would that affect his discretion?
It's just a factor that
I
goes to
the discretion. I don't
understand.
How is it a factor? If it's $10 a day or whatever it is, then what is his discretion? Can he say, if he finds the number of days, doesn't he have to multiply that by the per day penalty?
Right. There's cases that have been discussed where just the length of time not only goes to the obvious length of penalty per day, but it just shows, it goes to the issue of willfulness, goes to the issue of bad faith, which are factors. So it's all of those factors go to, and how
so
many
you're saying
employees.
Willfulness and bad faith, but not the resources of the defendant, that's irrelevant in your view?
In our view, it is. Now,
when a sanction is not compensatory in nature, can't the court take into account the ability of the defendant to pay? And isn't there an argument to be made that this was not compensatory?
Well, my argument is that anything that goes to the question of the inability to pay should come up like in a contempt situation. The cases that I've seen that were cited in this court's low opinion relate to contempt. That goes to if there's an award and then it's not paid, then can someone defend their position that they didn't or couldn't pay because of finances? But we believe it sets a bad precedent for all these requests have been made. There's harm to the plaintiff here, which
yes,
is another
but
factor.
When a plaintiff asks for punitive damages, isn't the wealth of the defendant a factor that a court considers?
Yes.
And ability to pay a fine, isn't that something that sentencing judges consider?
Oh, of course.
So why not here?
I think it's a different situation because in ERISA we have plan administrators. All of the case law says the whole idea behind penalties is to induce compliance.
It's with fines and with punitive damages. So what's the difference between them and statutory penalties?
I think
penalty?
Because of the nature of ERISA and the fact that...
Why is the nature of ERISA any different from any other kind? I mean, if you steal from your employer, you embezzle, that's a breach of fiduciary duty, and you can be fined and so on, but your wealth can be considered by the judge, can't it?
We believe under these circumstances...
What's special about these circumstances?
I think the special circumstances here was that even Judge Baker said this was self-professed poverty caused by the defendants themselves, for point one. Point two, we believe...
Caused by the defendants? What does that mean?
Well, they basically...
Threw their money away?
They raided their own corporation and paid themselves money and left the company in dire straits and unable to apparently pay penalties is what we believe the evidence shows. Actually, or at least that's what the evidence claimed. We believe, again, that...
Did he impose any penalties at all or zero?
He said...
No, what he said. What did he do? What did he do?
He gave zero. I mean, he didn't...
He gave zero.
Whether he gave zero or said there was no penalty.
What do you think he should have given?
We believe that he should have looked and ignored...
No, I'm asking you a more specific question. What should he have given you?
He should have given us...
How much?
In your low opinion, you were all on the panel. You gave
$50. Just answer my question. How much?
$50 a day.
How much? $50 a day for how many days?
We still don't have a summary plan description now. So all the way from the time of the demand in 2001 through trial, long-term disability plan was about 4 years. And the summary annual reports were never provided either. So we asked for, it was well over $200,000.
And you think he should have given you the $200,000?
Well, you asked me what we asked for,
right,
and that's what we think he should have given. But again, he had the discretion, but we don't think he had the discretion to just give zero. Your low opinion, Your Honors.
Okay, so you're saying zero is too little. Okay.
But your low opinion said poverty is not a defense.
Right.
Pardon?
Now, do you have anything else on your cross appeal?
That those are our main
points. Well, on your main appeal, I understand your argument that the 6-year, 3-year statute of limitation doesn't apply. Because you're claiming a breach of fiduciary duty. Your complaint is full of that stuff.
Okay. I have a number of arguments. First of all, they did not preserve the argument at all. They didn't raise the preemption argument on commissions, which I'm assuming what is
I'm
what
talking
they,
about
no,
preemption. I'm talking
that
about the statute of limitations.
Need to get to 1113's application, if any, to the commission's claim. But they specifically limited their statute of limitations to commissions. So they limited their defense to commissions, and that's the only way that 1113 can apply as a federal statute to a state law claim. It simply can't. Just stating it answers the question. So we don't think they've even preserved statute of limitations at all. Point two, Judge Baker gave us summary judgment on the matching contributions. That's what they're raising now. Statute of limitations bars matching contributions. He heard all of that at the summary judgment stage, said they did not have a proper summary judgment response. They don't even appeal that at this point. They don't even say that he was wrong about that. Now, my 1113 argument is as follows. All of the cases that we cite say there is a distinction between cases where the fiduciary breach has to do with someone who is still claiming denied benefits. Counsel cites the Labrisi case. Judge, I think you wrote that. And yes, that guy was barred by the 3-year statute. Totally different case than ours, because you noted there that there was a distinction, there would be a distinction if there were benefits still owed. And in that case, you said the guy admitted he didn't have any benefits still owed. Major distinction in our case. Plus, there was a tolling issue that the plaintiff didn't even argue, and we definitely argued in this case. I want to mention quickly.
Wait, I'm lost. So what 1113 says, no action may be commenced under this subchapter, which includes 1104, which you cite in your complaint, with respect to a fiduciary's breach of any responsibility, duty, or obligation under this part.
That's the key. I hate to interrupt you. That's the key. Under this part, part 4 is 1101 to 1114.
Right.
Those are the fiduciary
right.
duty
and your
responsibilities.
Complaint. You cite a violation of 1104, don't you?
No. What we say is that it was a general fiduciary breach that gets us under 1132. That's what the cases we cite in our brief, the Wright case, Kennedy, cases from other circuits have drawn that distinction between fiduciary breaches, more of the nature of, well, fiduciary, you didn't get proper bids for a contract for some type of service as a fiduciary versus someone who is denied benefits. That's the distinction that the cases draw. That's what the distinction we draw, and we think that's actually what the distinction
you
were drawing.
You say in paragraph 28 of your complaint, defendants have breached their fiduciary duties all pursuant to 29 U.S.C. section 1104.
But the evidence was to the contrary. Now, I want to mention
the
one.
The evidence was to the contrary?
What I mean understand. Is.
You lost that part of your case?
We did not, I shouldn't say the evidence. We didn't pursue this as an 1104 claim. We pursued this as an 1132 claim. I do want to mention.
Now, what's the difference?
1132 has to do with fiduciary breaches where you have not paid benefits as distinct from the 404 type of fiduciary breach, which deals with other types of fiduciary claims. That's what these cases say. I'm not making this up. This is what the other circuits have ruled in the cases that I cite to the court and
what
that we cited to Judge Baker.
What does 1104 say?
Pardon?
What does 1104 say?
1104 says a lot of things, one of which says if you're a fiduciary, you have to act consistent with the terms of the best interests of beneficiaries.
Which they didn't do.
Which they didn't do. But we
and
say.
Charge they didn't do.
Well, among many things that they didn't do, including not paying the clear benefits that were owed. I do want to mention one thing, and I think this
non-payment is not 1104, it's something else.
32. I do want to mention one thing on the 1113 argument. Defendants say that Judge Baker didn't rule, and I don't know how this court's going to rule as to whether he ruled or didn't rule. We think that it's implied that he did say that these issues were waived because we raised a motion in limine.
Anything?
Pardon?
He didn't mention anything. He just have overlooked it.
Well, I submit that he there's case law that says that you can imply that he ruled against them because the because of the waiver and other arguments that we make. But clearly, I don't think this court, if we do have an 1113 issue and you think it's 3 years, we certainly have the tolling and the estoppel, and whether it's 3 or 6
but
years.
But then there's no finding on equitable tolling.
Right, which means, well, all I'm saying is...
So we'd have to remand it back
well,
on that one.
Well, what I'm saying is they can't win outright. If you agree with them and disagree with us, we still have to go back and have our tolling and accrual presentation to Judge Baker. We can't have no findings and then come up here and lose completely on that issue.
And was that argument made, the equitable tolling argument made below?
Oh, yes. The cases that we cited to Judge Baker,
yeah,
too. Plus, this,
so
came
the same
up on,
one.
This came up on summary judgment in the reply, so all of the information is there for him, the affidavits, counter-affidavits on that point. Now, there clearly was, at least in our view, at a minimum, a question of fact on that. So I have the red light. Thank you, Your Honors. Unless
Thank
you have any
you,
other questions.
Iver. Mr. Roosevelt, how much time does he have? 3 minutes? Yes.
Thank you. I would like to speak to the issue of punitive damages or punitive charges here and where we might be going with this from a policy perspective. The requirement that Congress contemplated when it said, look, a plan participant needs access to the plan documents, clearly contemplates a situation, as you point out in Winchester, that the individual that feels they need the plan documents needs to take steps to get them on a prompt basis. We would be setting, I would respectfully suggest to you that you would be setting a very bad precedent if you say to an employee that you can leave this job, and in, particularly in this instance where counsel concedes now that the first demand for the plan documents was in 2001, just now before you, and we know the lawsuit was filed in May of 2005, that you can wait 4 years in order to take legal steps to get those plan documents and thus lead to a $50 fine that even would accrue to this hour per day.
Yeah, but there should be some penalty, shouldn't there? I don't understand a zero penalty.
I think you lose the protection as
he thought your judge thought your clients were terrible liars.
The question is, does a participant lose that status as participant, as you suggested in Winchester, where you wait in Winchester for 3 years or 2 years to seek those plan documents?
Well, that's the equitable tolling issue. So they may have been lulled. I mean, the plaintiff may have been lulled into thinking that this would be worked out.
Well,
by that would result in zero penalties.
In that instance, you will have plaintiffs filing these actions 4 years after they made the demand for the documents, and Congress's desire to see to it that plan participants step forward and get the plan documents and take reasonable steps to get them on a prompt basis. The punitive.
Well, but suppose we found, or the district judge found, that there was equitable tolling or equitable estoppel. That would wipe out your argument.
I disagree. It would be applicable in this instance because you lose your protection as a plan participant as a whole. You have no standing. You can't have an estoppel argument where you have no standing. As in Winchester, you said that there was no participation any longer because you look at the motives of an individual that waits that long. What are the motives of an individual that waits 3 or 4 years?
You're missing the point. Suppose we held that there was equitable estoppel. Then would you have any basis for objecting to the penalties?
Absolutely, because I don't believe that as definitionally the plaintiff remains a participant when they wait 4 years. I think they lose the protection of the statute. I think they lose standing. I don't think there's any argument that any equity can...
I don't know what you're talking about. Look, did you ever bring suit on this 20% deal, right? So she agreed to take a 20% cut in price and cut in pay in exchange for other benefits. And you claim that the defendants violated that contract, but there's no suit, is there? Or no claim based on that? That's been abandoned?
There is no suit. There is no claim. There was a financial distress, and that was reflected in the pay cut and the diminution of the benefits, as the court sees in the briefing on the issues that were presented with the dental plan and the disability plan. This was an organization under financial distress, as Judge Baker ably notes. Respectfully, thank you for your time.
Okay, well, thank you to both counsel.